You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, I'll have a conversation with someone in the food world I think you'll want to hear from. He is the chef owner of Camaraderie, a restaurant that just opened in the Heights. Sean Gall, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited you're here. I feel like we've been talking about doing this since long before, like, I think even longer than Camaraderie has had a location. You know, we've been sort of planning, like, when the restaurant opened, you would come on the show and talk about it. So I'm delighted you're here.
Yeah, well, same. It's finally all came together and came to fruition. So,
all right. So whenever anyone's been on the show for the first time, I always like to kind of ask them to start at the beginning. So tell me a little bit about how you became interested in becoming a chef.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I was young, you know, my dad had a restaurant deli. It was actually a Jewish delicatessen in Massachusetts. And, you know, I was just always around it. And I saw his workers having fun and the joy and the teamwork and, like, you know, the banter and stuff like that. And I also, like, got addicted to, like, kind of, like, the smells of the kitchen too. Like, he was known for a lot of, like, rotisserie chickens. And I still, to this day, like, rotisserie chicken, the smell of that is just quite amazing. And it takes me back, you know. The only thing better smelling coming out of the oven is probably Canelé de Bordeaux to me. But I learned that much later. But, you know, being around that, I was like, well, you know, I had fun. They were having fun. I want to do something, you know, for a career. If you're going to spend 40, 50 or more hours a week doing something, you have to have fun doing it. So, yeah, I was like, why do something else and have cooking as a hobby? I can, you know, be a chef or a cook and also have it be a hobby too. You know, I haven't gotten tired of it. So,
I mean, one of the things about your career, you know, I remember when you came to Goodnight Hospitality, you know, they were like, oh, well, he worked at L2O, which was a 2-star Michelin seafood restaurant in Chicago. And he worked at Cezanne, which was a 3-star Michelin restaurant in San Francisco. That, you know, there was a moment when you could have reasonably argued it was the best restaurant in America. Like, you know, maybe people would have disagreed with you. That's a very contentious sort of claim to make, but you know, you've had some of these really incredible experiences. So how did you kind of go from, like, working in your dad's deli to working at some of the best restaurants in the country?
I guess I had a bit more ambition. And even when I was like 12, people would ask me if I would take over my dad's deli. And I like literally said I would tear it down and build a real restaurant. And so, kind of rude. You know, when I was working at my dad's deli when I was young, I also actually started working at this small family-owned, you know, Italian restaurant. And it was my second grade teacher. Her husband, she retired from teaching, and her husband opened a restaurant. And it was called La Garlic. And it was kind of fancy for suburbs, you know, and, like, We did like a lobster fest in August, and it had like 20 different lobster dishes on the menu, and like really got to, cook with a little bit of technique when I was, 15 or 16, and making like chicken marsala and chicken piccata and stuff like this, right? And then the energy in that kitchen. And, I knew then too, I was like working kind of part-time at my dad's and then a little bit more there. And my high school had a program where if you had a job, you could leave school a little early. So I did that. It's like a work study. So it's kind of a workaround, which is kind of fun. I just always kind of wanted a little bit more. So I went to New England Culinary Institute in Vermont. It was a very small school, and I knew that the instructors would really hold me to, learning all the curriculum, and as soon as I started culinary school, I really took it serious. And from there, I just tried to pick places where I surround myself with passionate people. Whether it be, I worked at a bunch of Four Seasons hotels when I was younger. And what was cool is that they had like four or five sous chefs, and they were from all different backgrounds, right? And you can learn so much from all different people. That was pretty amazing. And then from there, they would recommend where I should go next, right? And it was like, oh, well, I spent 6 years at the Four Seasons Philadelphia for Jean-Marie Lacroix, like not me personally, but one of the mentors in Boston. And he's like, they do a classic brigade system where you learn more as you go, So I was like, okay, then I'm gonna take your advice and I'm gonna do that. And sure enough, it was like that was awesome. It was a big stepping stone in my career. And then from there, I just looked for people that were passionate and that were leading by example. So, Laurent Gras, Joshua Skeans. Even before that, when I moved to Chicago a long time ago, it was the two restaurants there were Charlie Trotter's or True. And Charlie Trotter's was on break when I was moving there. So I kind of lined up with True, and Graham Elliott Bowles hired me. He was the chef de cuisine at True at the time. But when he hired me, I was 20 years old. He told me that, unfortunately, he was going to go back to Charlie Trotter's in like a month. But in that month that I worked with him, he would stop the whole kitchen and call people over and like 12, 15 cooks in that brigade just to like show them the matsutake mushrooms or like the heirloom tomatoes we got in. And he would cut one and just have us all taste it. And that pause and that moment and him showing how excited he was about the product and how passionate it was like that was, kind of long lasting, right? And kind of set the tone where it's like, when I look for a job, I want to work for people like that, Unfortunately, I never got to work with him again, but I've worked with other people that were very similarly passionate, right? So.
Yeah, I mean, just talk a little bit about Cezanne, because as I said, it had this kind of lofty reputation, and you were there in that moment when they went from two Michelin stars to three Michelin stars. So what are kind of the lessons or what are the memories you have of that time of being involved at a kitchen that was really operating at, certainly by any professional standard, like some of the highest levels in the country?
I guess like the lessons is all in consistency, I think, right? There was, when I was there for 3 years, the first couple of years when we had two stars, I think a lot of people on the staff really thought they were deserving of three. But I think you can like when you're there every day and you see the little things, you always see that there's little things you can improve, right? So, and those will stand out when you're going at such a high level. Like a small mistake, or at least to me, stands out even like tenfold, right? But yeah, I mean, all those little things matter. Everything matters, and all the little things add up to that complete experience. And I think Cezanne is a good example of that, right? And it's not just, seasoning with shiradashi and all these things, but it's the product, how we took care of it, and all the way from start to finish, the vibe in the dining room, how you cut your tape, how you organize your prep list, like how you work as a team. how we ran food to the tables and like every little thing. And it was such a showcase kitchen, and it was completely open that it was like you had to be, just kind of like perfect. And there's no perfection, right? But there's all sorts of like the cleanliness had to be sharpened up every single time, and we make a tiny little mistake. That's the difference, one or two mistakes a year. You never know when a Michelin inspector is there to see that, So, yeah.
Yeah, and you can't, like, if you drop something, you can't shout expletives in the middle of the, because then all the customers will hear you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the first tables are only feet away. So, and I kind of build a camaraderie kind of similarly where the tables are very, very close to the kitchen. So they can
All
kind of see it all. Yeah.
right. Well, I want to get to camaraderie, but before we do, I did want to talk about your time at Goodnight Hospitality.
Yeah.
How did you make your way to Houston? Like, 'cause you've been working at some of these restaurants. I mean, it seems like from my perspective, you were kind of taking a risk on like a startup hospitality group that didn't have much of a reputation at that point.
Yeah, well, I had known June Riddell for a long time. So we have a couple of mutual friends in common. Through my travels, I've actually randomly met a lot of people from Texas. And I've kept good in touch with them. I met June a long time ago when she was working at Uchi. And, some of my friends from when I worked at Robuchon or L2O like grew up with her. So she actually recruited me. She first recruited me to Austin to help with McGuire Mormon. And they were expanding. And I took a trip out, and I was kind of impressed with Texas, and I saw an opportunity too, because the things I like to do about my job and like how I've grown in the industry is the teaching and the mentorship part of it. So that was where that opportunity was. And then I could also just see like, yeah, it's a risk. Whether it be McGuire Mormon or moving from there to follow her to Goodnight, it was a risk worth taking to try to see if I could find a little more balance, in quality of life. So, yeah, it was always worth taking a little risk. But I saw that opportunity of building something new, and also the teaching and mentorship that they really preached was kind of important and a driving factor.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you were involved with all of their concepts. I mean, primarily with, Rosie Cannonball and March. So, I mean, I've been sort of raving about everything at Rosie Cannonball, like from the early days, the focaccia and the gelatos and a lot of the other things that you were involved in. So just talk a little bit about kind of creating that program and kind of getting it to, obviously, like you've moved on, and they have some pretty talented people still running that program, but just talk about getting that thing off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was great. I mean, working with Felipe was awesome. He's very intelligent, very collaborative, and also very passionate. So, talking food with him was easy. It was good. It was pretty simple. I mean, he had a lot of trust with me as well. So, when I first came to meet, it was pretty casual. He's like, "Let's just cook together." And we did it at the farm, and we kind of just cooked a dinner. And some of the things I did was the focaccia de Recco, because I thought it would match the concept. And I had it in LA at Chief's Baca, Nancy Silverton's restaurant, and was just blown away by it. And I'm like, I need to try this myself. And like some of the other food, we kind of just it worked. Like I was talking chicken basquez because I love, like I got taught that from an ex Robuchon, chef who grew up in the Basque country, and the Basque cheesecake and stuff. And then we started being like, oh, we can burn in the wood fire and all this stuff. So it was like, it was very easy just to like talk food. And I would have an idea, and sometimes Felipe would say like, okay, well, what about this, or can we add this? And so I think that was, it was good. It was great. I mean, doing openings are always challenging, right? But I think the backgrounds between June, Felipe, David at the time, It was like we could really divvy up the work. And June has tons of systems in place and is very organized. Working for them for the 3 plus 3 4 years, I forget. It was good, and it was a learning experience, and I definitely grew a lot throughout that time too. I don't think, if I opened Camaraderie, 5 8 years ago, I wouldn't be the same manager or the same person, right? And they definitely helped me grow, which was awesome.
So, I guess, I haven't said the words pastry chef yet in this conversation, but that's what you were known for. Certainly what you were doing at Goodnight and at Cezanne and some of these other stops along the way. So,
It's hard to get
what
away
made
from it.
you, the obvious question is like what made you want to kick over to Savory into a restaurant? Like, why isn't this a bakery, Sean Gall?
Well, one, I've never worked at a bakery, so that's one. And to talk, bakeries just don't make sense to me. I don't know. I've always been a restaurant person. The mass production, the waste in a bakery, I don't know. Just the volume, the price per person. I don't know. The numbers just don't. They obviously work and it's scalable, but I can't wrap my head around it. But I've always been passionate about restaurants and giving someone an experience. And doing pastry was only supposed to be like a year or two project. And somehow, I don't know, it ended up being 10 or 12 years and I got known for it, or maybe it was 15. I'm old. When someone really likes something and writes about it, then someone else comes. And then I met with Jonathan Benno years ago, and I wanted to like try to promote myself of someone that could do both. And I was, I was at L2O and I was at Veritas, and I was like, oh, I could be like a tournant and I can help the pastry team and help over here. And he's like, but you're good at pastry. Why don't you just keep doing that? It's like I tried to get out, I couldn't. And then I ended up at Corton, and then I got more recognition there. And there was kind of no looking back. So yeah. But I mean, pastry's been extremely fun and extremely humbling. And it's definitely kept my interest for a long time as well. So, and very challenging. So, I have no regrets. I like cooking, whether if it's with sugar or salt or, flour, pastries, and yeah, whatever the ingredient is. I like the technique and the cooking and getting my hands in it and creating, and then also just sharing with people. So.
So how did you sort of reach the point where you realized that, as much as you liked working at Goodnight, that the time had kind of come to go out on your own and open your own restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, I always had in my mind, it was just a matter of what city made sense and what town. And I met my wife here. We're building a family here. So, it was time that I was like, okay, I think this is home, and like what's, and I also saw opportunity in the market that I felt like Camaraderie had a place, or the idea and the concept had a place here. So, I definitely took my time. I revisited my business plan, and my ideas, and kind of like looked slowly for restaurant spaces, as you know, because we talked, and you've kind of known I've been planning, but wanted to get the right location that kind of spoke to me, and it was quite, difficult. And I found a couple, and then they'd be taken, or another, person swoops in. It's just like taking my time. But that was another thing that was great about Goodnight, is I felt comfortable having open communication about all this, and they're very supportive. So it's good.
All right, so how did you land up in a former,
Yeah,
I mean, warehouse, mechanic shop, whatever you want to call it, on 11th Street in the Heights?
I don't know, by chance, by luck, but my landlord, Brian Dana, he has a good eye for certain, projects and redeveloping, places. So when I saw it, I saw there was a standalone building, and it was kind of the right size. So I didn't want to do something too big. I just saw a lot of potential, and it was kind of a clean slate. So I kind of kept going back to that space.
So talk about kind of the ethos behind Camaraderie, because, a lot of times I sort of joke that restaurant names are like band names. They don't necessarily mean anything. They just need to be sort of memorable. If you can get thatthing.com, like you're good, basically, you know, a unique Instagram handle, whatever. But I know camaraderie is a little different, and I know that it kind of speaks to like the ethos that you're bringing to this project. So say a little bit about the name, because I think it's important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of thought went into it. I kind of came up with the name when I was in San Francisco. I was thinking if I was going to do a restaurant, I needed the name to be meaningful to me. And I kept thinking about what kept driving me in the business, right? And I think it's the connections I've made throughout my years, you know. That's been extremely meaningful and keeps me going, you know. How much the chefs share and help each other out, like just is very heartwarming to me, and it's very impressive. So, you know, I've had past, cooks and sous chefs. They keep in touch. I need something, they need something. I get invited to their wedding, which is just like, heartwarming as well. Like, use that word again, but it means a lot. And those lasting relationships, like literally, I've had friends for 20 plus years because we were in the trenches together, right? And we helped each other out. We saw each other at our worst moments, right? But now you can pick up the phone anytime and get together with someone and catch up like that, you know. It's a pretty amazing thing.
And then, the other thing that's a little bit unusual about camaraderie is you're not a tasting menu restaurant and you're not an a la carte restaurant. You're kind of doing both with this prefix menu with the shared appetizers and a couple of entree choices, and then a small a la carte menu so that people can kind of choose their own adventure. What made you want to go that route? Like, why not one or the other? Why both?
Well, throughout my years, I've worked at mainly tasting menu restaurants, and there's a lot that I loved, and there's a lot that I didn't really like, you know. So I wanted to try to kind of bridge the gap. I wanted to offer people a similar experience with the quality of product, the time and care that goes into it. But I was trying to think of a restaurant a little bit differently, you know, especially during COVID. I felt like the whole restaurant industry got, taken aback and kind of got caught, with I guess with their pants down a little bit, like whether they're stuck with having to offer a certain product that they're known about, and then the prices are all over the board, or staffing is a huge crisis in the industry too. So it's like, how can I think of the restaurant where I can do a similar quality and experience, the price point be a bit more approachable, the time that the guest spends in the restaurant too, but then also like not having to have a whole, a huge staff to produce it, right? And we have a team. So, a slightly smaller menu, a little more focused. I'd like to say simple food, but some is pretty technical as well. And a lot of time goes into it. But I think if the team works as a team and all helps each other out, we can get more done. But the food style, I just don't feel like many guests really want to dine for 3+ hours anymore, or if they do it, it's once a year. Well, I want people to come back more often than that, and I want people to experience, and we're able to get people, that full experience in, an hour and a half. And then if some people want to spend a little bit longer, they can. And then they can still have that same, Michelin quality, dining experience and food, but very approachable. And the a la carte portion, it kind of just worked with the space too, where if I were to have a bar and like the problem with my concept is that I don't have for the prefix, there's not a lot of choices, right? There's only a few choices for an entree and there's a couple of choices for dessert. Well, that kind of like pigeonholes me in a certain area where I'm not a tasting menu, but I'm kind of forcing people down a certain path. Well, I want people to be able to pop in and have a snack and a bite and a drink too, and have a few more options, and you can build your own experience. So I was able to keep my main dining room and the prefix a bit smaller, like I wanted, and that's my passion, project. And then for the neighborhood that people can walk to and pop in, then we have the bar lounge patio with a little a la carte, which we're actually, most of it is reserved for walk-ins. So not reserved, but blocked for walk-in guests to be able to come in and pop in anytime.
And one of the things I like about what you're doing with the prefix is that it's only $75 a person. And like I'm the passionate defender of a place like March. Like if you love restaurants and dining and you want to experience it at the highest level, you will pay the freight, and it will be, that six courses with the wine pairings will run you about $400 or $500 a person, and it will be expensive and it will be worth it.
Absolutely.
But like you said, like that's a once a menu, like maybe you eat there twice a year, right? As often as they change the menu, and you're going for something a little more neighborhood, a little more regular. And so, that $75 price point puts you in that, $200, $250 dinner for two, where, it's not an inexpensive proposition, but it's not like you can do that once a month. I think, depending on your income and your priorities and all that stuff, but it's not unreasonable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've compared this to maybe going to a concert, right? Like the Rolling Stones like comes around every once in a while, right? And you're gonna spend a few hundred dollars or $500 on a ticket for the Stones, and it's that whole experience. Well, that's what restaurants like March is, and it's what, and it's worth it, But yeah, you do that once or twice a year. And I absolutely agree that it's worth it for me as well, and the experience. But yeah, I mean, I want people to come once a month, and like to do that, I have to just build things a little differently. And 75 is not, it is not cheap, and to some it might be a special occasion still, and to others it's very reasonable. And then that's where the a la carte comes in too, where like, yeah, they can maybe do the full pre-fee, once or twice a year, but then they'll come into the bar more often, right? And have a snack and a drink or whatever it is, or one of the pastas or something. So trying to, be friendly and neighbor, offer something for everyone.
Yeah, and just say a little more about the prefix menu. I mean, how did you kind of settle on those dishes as what you want to open with?
Yeah, I mean, well, one is a little bit of the season, and even the pre-fee will probably start to change soon as we're getting into product. I had a couple of years of looking for a space, so I had a couple of years of trying out some dishes and getting feedback. So it was a little bit of that, but I want to try to have some balance, and try to do things a little more vegetable forward, a little more sustainable. So I kind of pick things along that way. And one dish that's been getting, good feedback is the salt baked celery root. And originally it was going to be like a tuna or hamachi crudo. And as I was testing, and I had a group that I was doing this for, I had a vegetarian and I had to come up with a substitute. And the salt baked celery root was actually honestly better than the tuna or the hamachi version, And I was like, why not just offer this? And it's delicious, and it's friendly. And then we have, a little bit of, it's mainly vegetable for the shared, and we might have some protein here or there, but you basically pick your protein, for your entree. And yeah, it kind of just worked out. But that's just like one example where it's like it was kind of eye-opening. It was like I threw it together. I made this like miso mayonnaise and did the salt baked celery root that like whole baked it, let it steam in its own skin, like season it up, and then when we taste it later, it's like, oh, this is like delicious. And I just want to put delicious food out there. So try to
Well,
put
and
together my
nothing
best.
from nothing, but like a lot of people have hamachi crudo, and don't get me wrong, I basically order it every time I see it, but you don't have to do that. I mean, plenty of other people do that.
Well, yeah, exactly. And when it was in season, I was doing tuna, tomato, and watermelon. So it was like all red, different textures and crunch. And we might revisit that, but then at the same time I did this and I was like, oh, well, this is different and a little bit, unique, but ultimately I just want to give people delicious food. So try to pick dishes that, spoke to me, but also spoke to the people I've been cooking for, and I've gotten great food feedback. So yeah, I wanted to open strong, I guess. And but we're gonna start rotating things. And the dishes that really get great feedback, the idea is that we'll move them to the bar lounge area and we'll keep them around so they'll be accessible there too. So if we keep the menu rotating, well, then like the things that people, crave about, they'll be accessible in the lounge.
One of the other things that you sort of talked about, like one of the reasons you wanted to move to Texas was, a little better work-life balance. You mentioned you and your wife just started a family. So what are some of the things you're doing at Camaraderie to kind of facilitate that for your staff so that they have, that it's not that like crazy obsession, all-consuming thing?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I mean, we want the whole staff to be on a 4-day work week. They'll have 10, 12-hour days, or at least the kitchen will have, 4 10 to 12-hour days. The other things is that we're trying to bridge the gap on the pay discrepancy. So we are paying a full minimum wage. So we're not taking a tip credit. That meaning, all the servers are making a real minimum wage, and we can tip the whole staff across the board a little bit more equally. And it works out where the cooks get a good bump and gets closer to where the servers are, and kind of working on that a little more fair. So it's a concept called One Fair Wage. And it's kind of a movement going around the country, and slowly, like Birdie's implemented something very similar in Austin. I've talked to Arjav a little bit about it and gotten feedback. We're gonna, try to do little things. When we close, we're gonna, pay our staff, and putting away money to do that. So every 6 months, if we have a closure, we'll do one closure in the summer. Maybe not this summer because we're gonna be a little bit too new. And we'll have another closure, come the first of the year. I want to pay my staff for that time. They deserve it.
Right, of course, but Birdie's is a slightly different service model in that it's counter service and you stand in line. And I don't like I respect that as both like a business philosophy and an approach. And as I was doing it, I just was as a customer, I was like, I can't ever see this flying in Houston.
Yeah, I don't know if people like to queue in Houston, and with the heat. And Austin is still hot, but it's very different, right? So certainly I have a much different concept than Birdie's, but the pay and the tip out structure is something I've worked on, and even and talked to Art, like I said, talked to Arjav. But then, I went to the chef's conference last year, and there was a whole, platform forum about how we can treat, the industry better and what we can do and what different people from around the country were kind of doing things differently, right? And it was, kind of an open discussion, which was awesome. Their model for labor being counter service, that's how they were able to figure out to streamline labor. Mine is with and their menu is also quite small, which makes sense to me too. And there's many factors, right? And mine, I kind of wanted to streamline the steps of service, whether it be the options and the ordering, the menu format, the shareables. We're putting out a good amount of plates, but we're putting out a little bit less plates because there's shared things. So not everyone is, a taste menu, four top gets, four times six, four times nine, maybe then some, right? So this, you're getting a similar amount of different options, but have it being shared, it's a little more streamlined labor too. So that should all help in the long run. And yeah, but 4-day work week, we're going to be adding a 401k soon. It just takes a little bit of time. There's a lot of stuff you can't do until you're like a few weeks to opening. Health and dental is another one. You can't really get that going until you have people on payroll. And now it's like have to follow up. So those little things we're going to continue to implement, and then we'll, you know, try to always, you know, get better and kind of grow a little bit too. I want this to be, and being a chef and a cook to be a career again, right? The other thing is, like, I'm really big on education and mentorship, like I mentioned earlier. So, you know, I want to change the menu. I want to get people involved. I want to teach them or like talk to them about food, so people aren't stagnant and it's not like they're hired and they're a short order cook, right? So I want to keep things moving and get them inspired, you know, like, okay, green garlic is coming, right? Or it's here now. Like, I already opened with this one bread, right? But I was like, we can do a green garlic naan. Like, we should do that in like a week or two, you know, like maybe we keep the menu the same for like a week or two. And then, you know, for all fairness. But then it was like, my mind's already kind of kicking around where it's like, oh, we can do this. And like, rhubarb is in, we should do something, you know? And then you see the cook's eyes light up too, you know? So it's contagious.
Let me just ask you one other thing. I mean, you had your first week of service.
Yeah.
How did it go? I mean, are people kind of getting it? Are they excited about it? How do you feel like it went?
I think it went great. Yeah. People are getting it. There's a lot of the neighborhood that's been coming in. They're like appreciative and thankful, and yeah, it's, pretty amazing feeling, must say. So yeah, we've gotten great feedback so far, which is awesome. So,
all right. And then the one other thing obviously is, you know, you've worked at all of these Michelin starred places and now Michelin is here. Do you have an aspiration? I mean, I kind of look at the, you know, the Bib Gourmand that went to places like Nancy's Hustle and Nobis and Theodore Rex and think, like, you know, if camaraderie is running right, that you should be in the mix for that kind of recognition.
Yeah. I mean, any recognition would be great. Right. You know, but it's not why we do things. Right. And I want to I constantly remind my staff, it's a hard balance where they know that I have very high standards. So they're, you know, making things very, very nice, which is great. But even like the knife cuts, right? It was like, if I don't get a Michelin star because we don't have perfect knife cuts, but we're utilizing more product, I'm okay with that. You know, like, that's great. Like, hey, they started giving out green stars. Those are awesome. But a bib, like, that speaks to giving your guests value, that's an awesome recognition too. So yeah, I mean, we're going to do what we're going to do, and, you know, time will tell, but, you know, I'm proud of my team so far.
Yeah. You know, I had that conversation, recently with Aaron Bludorn, who, you know, was kind of the OG Michelin skeptic. And he was like, you know, he's kind of come around because he likes that it gives your staff something to aspire to.
Yeah.
And I think, like, as long as you're not like trying to game the system or put dishes on the menu to like lure the inspectors, you know, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And there's always the Culture Map Tastemaker Awards.
Right. There is.
I mean, they're basically the same thing, right?
Yeah. I think they're this week. No,
it is. Yes. Yes. We'll be talking about the winners next week. Well, Sean, I have to say that does bring me to the end of my questions. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you would like to discuss?
You know, I find like that, you know, the passion that you give and talking about food with your team and like, you know, rhubarb or green garlic and their eyes light up and like you showing how much passion you have, it's contagious, right? And then all of a sudden people come into work and it's totally different, right? And they're excited. So I don't know. Those are kind of the things I want to build. So, but I think you covered quite a bit. Thank you.
Awesome. All right. Well, before I let you go, we have to play the lightning round.
Yeah.
Five easy questions, five short answers. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. Sean Gall, what is your favorite ingredient?
Sesame.
What is the first band you ever saw in concert?
Eric Clapton.
What is your fast food guilty pleasure? It has to come from a restaurant with a drive-thru.
Burger King original chicken sandwich.
Usually I ask people for their favorite Houston sports figure, but since you grew up in the Boston area, Who is your favorite Boston sports figure, past or present?
I'd probably say Ray Bourque, Boston Bruin. I was a big hockey fan growing up.
That is such a Boston. It's like, no, not Larry Bird, not Tom Brady, not David Ortiz. No, Ray Bourque. That's such a Boston answer. I'm delighted by it. All right, and then finally, since I know you've been busy trying to get your restaurant open, and you probably won't have any free time for the next 6 months, but what is the new Houston restaurant you haven't been to yet but are dying to try?
Sadly, I haven't been to Tatamo yet, and it's high on our list. And my wife being pregnant for a while, we wanted to go there and have their experience fully, right? And not have any substitutes. So sadly, I haven't been there. We're gonna
That's
get
a good
there.
answer. All right. Sean, give us the website and the social media for Camaraderie.
Yeah, camaraderiehtx.com, and the social is camaraderiehtx.
Easy peasy. Sean, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Eric.
You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemop.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims. Sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.